Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And with all the recent market turmoil, are young novice investors spooked, taking their money and running for the cash hills, or are they staying calm and carrying on? Lee investigates. Well, if you are a little bit nervous, we take a look at the DIY platforms offering ready-made ISA portfolios. Also today, what the hell is happening to the price of oil? It tanked this week. Why and what happens next? Can anyone make even a close to accurate prediction right now about that? And as Simon asks, house prices. Don't worry, people are, as always. Meanwhile, we take a look at some simple ways to spruce up your home for those looking for a quick post-lockdown sale. And Hiscox is threatened with legal action from businesses who say they should be covered for coronavirus. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, remember on last week's episode, Simon and I discussed the idea, well, it was mainly Simon, that if this recent episode has given minor investors a lesson, it is that 5 years is not long enough. Well, Lee, in his weekly consumer column, has been looking at stocks and shares ISAs, which suffered their biggest losses in a tax year since the financial crisis in 2019-20. Now, This Is Money did a spot of research and found that not an insignificant number of people are selling a significant amount of their investments since all this started, and over half regret investing so much. So who are these people? Should they keep calm and carry on? And what, Lee, is the issue with LISAs? But Lee, first of all, tell us more. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Georgie. Yes, obviously I was meant to be on the show last week, but some technical issues prevented me coming on, which was a bit of a frustrating time, but we're here. It's all sorted now. I think I've got to the root of the problem. So thank you, Georgie. Yes, you're right. This week, my consumer column, I'm looking at the novice investors. I'm looking at those who have kind of got fed up with savings on rates with normal savings and have been tempted into going into investing. Now, we've spoken about this quite a lot in recent years, and it's probably never been easier to invest, via things like stocks and shares, ISAs. Now, there's some stats around this anyway that I found incredibly interesting as I was researching this. So according to the Taxman, £69 billion was put into adult ISAs in 2017-2018. And that's a combination of cash ISAs and stocks and shares ISAs and a couple of the other smaller sort of ISAs that are out there. The interesting part of this, though, is that there was an increase of £7.8 billion compared to the tax year before. But the Taxman says the rise was driven pretty much completely by stocks and shares ISA subscriptions. So the number of cash ISAs subscribed fell by almost 700,000 in 2017-2018, which is the most up-to-date year that we've got stats for. But the number going for stocks and shares ISAs rose by almost 250,000. So it shows that there's been a lot of people pulling out money from cash ISAs have got fed up with the rock bottom rates and are going into stocks and shares ISAs, perhaps chasing better returns. You know, it could be some word of mouth. It could be, you know, just doing some more research, but seeing that you could get returns that are going to be better than 1.5%, which you're going to get in a cash ISA. Now, the reason I've been looking into this, actually, since lockdown, I've been listening to quite a bit of commercial radio. Now, I'm not really a radio listener. I don't really have time when I'm working Monday to Friday commuting in. I just never really listen to the radio. But every single radio station, commercial radio station that we listen to, has this same advert at the moment, which is saying, have you been missold a stocks and shares ISA from a bank? Which I think is really quite interesting. Obviously, for a lot of claims management firms, we've seen the PPI gravy train stop and they're having to look elsewhere. And of course, I've written about this extensively, actually, about bank mis-selling in the past. And yes, there has been a lot of investment mis-selling. But I think in terms of stocks and shares ISAs, when I looked into this, it seemed to be a lot more complex investments rather than a stocks and shares ISA. And I think for the vast majority of people, they kind of know what they were letting themselves in for opening stocks and shares ISA. You know that investments can fall as well as they can rise and all of those kind of caveats that come with it. So I was interested in looking into this and looking into the sentiment of people at the moment, given that coronavirus obviously rocked the markets during March and into April, and whether that had panicked people. There was some data out this week from MoneyFacts, actually, that showed since ISAs were introduced in 1999, there's been positive growth in 14 of the 21 years since stocks and shares ISAs were launched. So for two in every 3 years, stocks and shares ISAs gone up, but there have been some bad years. So it looked in the last 12 months, so the 12-month period, the last tax year, a typical stocks and shares ISA fell 13.3% in that 12-month period. That's quite a chunky blow for people when they're logging into their accounts, seeing that kind of fall, never seen that kind of fall before, because they might be new to investing. They might not, you know, even, and when I say new to investing, you could say really in the last 10 years, because they wouldn't have seen the financial crisis. They wouldn't have been rocked by that. They wouldn't have been impacted by that. And actually, the Money Facts research did show there were two worse years. So 2008, 2009, there was a 20.3% fall. And in 2002, 2003, there was a 19.7% fall. But we must remember that this goes up to the end of the tax year. So, you know, it's hard to know what's going to be 2020, 2021 returns. But would it be positive? Would it be negative? Who knows? At the moment, it's so difficult to tell with everything that's going on. And I looked at Google Trends research, so what people were searching for. And for the first time ever in the last few months, stocks and shares ISA's search engine term is that above that of cash ISA. So it suggests more people are searching out how to invest in stocks and shares ISA's rather than cash ISA's, which I think is a really interesting turn of events, because cash ISA has always been that kind of popular tax-free place to stash cash. But with rates dwindling, I think people are going, let's get involved in investing. So this leads me nicely onto the research that I've had exclusively done for us. I work with a company called Harris Interactive that do some exclusive studies for us. So they did a snap survey of people who hold investments. And according to that study, 65% of respondents have sold a significant amount of investments since coronavirus started to have an impact in early March, and 55% regretting investing as much as they have thanks to coronavirus rocking the markets. Now, we saw the FTSE 100, it bottomed out. It went below 5,000 on the 23rd of March. It's nudging closer to 6,000 now, but at the start of the year, it was getting close to 8,000. So that's the kind of falls that we're talking about. And actually, in the survey again, more than 3 in 10 never expected stock markets could fall so much in such a short space of time, which I think is really quite interesting. People just really didn't believe that that kind of fall could happen. And I focused on FTSE 100 here, but we could talk about basically most markets around the world when we say that. And 2 in 5 are saying that thanks to the coronavirus crash, they're less likely to invest in the future, which is, I think, a hefty amount of people that have been burnt by what's happened here and gone, ooh, and got nervous. Maybe their sentiment will change if the markets recover, as they have done a little bit in recent weeks. But it's so volatile out there. And I think actually the interesting bit, really interesting bit of this, is those who've only been investing in the last 10 years are almost three times as likely to regret investing as much as they've done than seasoned investors. So when I say seasoned investors, people that have been investing for longer than 10 years, and they are also three times as likely to have sold a significant portion of their investments compared to those who've been investing for longer. So that kind of indicates that people, especially novice investors, have been spooked by recent events.
It's not really a surprise, though, to a certain degree, because those people who are pretty new, the young people who've got involved with it, won't have had enough time, really, to see almost the benefits of that. And then, like you said, this spooking. There's a bit of a flip reverse with that, in the fact that more people are searching for stocks and shares ISAs, which in the past, Lee, you know, we've always spoken about, there's not enough people, young people, that are willing to get involved in investing. So this is potentially good news. And then you flip it with the number of people who are trying to get out of investing or regretting investing at the moment. But is stocks and shares, do you think the reason that people are looking it up more is... A little bit in part, I suppose, because it straddles that, doesn't it? The sort of cash, the ISA. It feels a little bit safer, and I'm using inverted commas here, than, you know, full-on investing. It's sort of an easy way in. But also you get a lot of these apps, like Moneybox apps, which perhaps are more targeted at young people, so it's more normalised.
Exactly. I would agree with you there, Georgie. It's become far easier. There's a lot of easy DIY investing platforms out there, and a lot of people, especially younger investors, are likely to drip feed cash into a stocks and shares ISA. It's very unlikely that they'll get up to the £20,000 tax-free limit that we get each year at the moment. But it makes it so easy, all of these places. I think once upon a time, investing was seen as a very difficult endeavor. You had to jump through a lot of hoops and a lot of difficulties and, you know, just getting through those first hurdles. But now it really is quite simple to open them up. And actually, to go back to a point there you made about, well, it's perhaps good to see younger people investing. Actually, a large slab of people that responded in this who are under 35 are actually saying that, you know, perhaps they will just carry on. They will just keep calm and going because they're taking a longer term view. So you pointed out last week that we were talking about 10 years, not 5 years, maybe should be the minimum term people should consider when investing. And there were some interesting charts sent to us by Schroders this week, which kind of highlighted that. So it's got this the graph that goes steadily down, and it's the percentage of the time where investors would have lost money in inflation adjusted terms. So over 5 years, 19.5%. Basically, it's potentially the time investors would have lost money if they'd invested over 5 years. This drops to 11.5% over 10 years, and it drops to 0.1% over 20 years. That is a powerful graph. And it shows that taking a long-term view and not having perhaps knee-jerk reactions to, you know, market turmoil. This is market turmoil that we haven't seen for, you know, for a very, very long time. And, you know, rightly so, people are a little bit scared, are a little bit spooked. And I've made the point in this column, Georgie, and you mentioned earlier about lifetime ISAs. There's not many cash lifetime ISA options out there. So lifetime ISA is for younger people. They can put away up to £4,000 a year, get 25% government bonus. You have two options for this. You have a cash version, or you have a stocks and shares investing version. Now, a lot of people, we've argued that this product muddies the waters between saving for a home and saving for retirement, two very different options. There are some people out there that would have been using this to save for a home, would have opened an investing account version of the lifetime ISA and thinking, oh, we're going to buy a house in the next couple of years. I'm not sure it would have been the most sensible thing to do, but when you're looking at the returns on offer elsewhere, people might have been tempted into that, and they might now be seeing quite big losses on pots being safer for homes. And I think, you know, again, it highlights just how it's a good product if you're going to save for a first home and use as a cash ISA version, but I'm not sure about as for retirement.
Yeah, I think the government bonus that you get is pretty much compensating, so you're probably just putting in the amount that you would anyway. I'm going to ask you about the stocks and shares ISAs and DIY platforms, but I want to bring Simon into this because you mentioned there about graphs. We had a Twitter follower get involved with this debate. Simon, what was that all about?
Okay, so that's what Lee would just mentioned earlier in terms of the graph showing the amount of time that you can that you would need to invest for in order to avoid losing money. Duncan Lamont at Schroders, the investment management firm. We've been having an ongoing conversation about some of this stuff for some time with Duncan, and they do some really good research over there, actually. He's helped us out with some good stuff before, and he's got a great chart, which Lee was talking about. But it's also got another chart which shows the percentage of time where investors would have lost money in inflation-adjusted terms in cash versus investing. And to put it into context, as Lee said, over 5 years, inflation adjusted, you would have any 5 year period between January 1871 and March 2020. Okay. So there are two things to take into account here. One, that is going to be slightly skewed by the fall in the stock market recently, which will be included in these figures. So they're kind of fair figures because they take into account a lot of that fall. Two, it's over a very, very long period of time. And I think that although past performance is no guide to future returns, as the small print on the adverts say, you can probably take some solace from looking at figures that go all the way back to 1871. And the 19.5% chance of losing money in inflation-adjusted terms over 5 years if you invest in the stock market, and the stock market being measured here is the S&P 500, compares to a 78.8% chance of losing money in inflation adjusted terms if you put your money in cash over that same 5 year period. that's quite interesting, really. So what it's saying is you've got pretty much a 20% chance of losing money over 5 years if you invest. But if you just keep your money in cash, you've got nearly an 80% chance that the money that you put in there will not be worth what it was worth when you put it in there once you take into account inflation. However, there is one very, very important thing to consider here. And that is that whilst the stock market data comes from the S&P 500, the cash return is based on a three-month US Treasury bill, okay, which is considered to be a measure of the return on cash. Now, if you're a saver and you're putting your money into a account, if you've got any common sense, you will go and look for the best possible account. So you will go to somewhere, for example, like thisismoney.co.uk/save, mm-hmm. where you would find our independent Best Buy savings tables, which have the best accounts in them. And if you want to put your money in cash, go to those, look at what the top accounts are, put them in there, because you will get an awful lot more interest than you would get in the average account or leaving your money sat in a legacy account, and an awful lot more interest than you would do in the equivalent rate that's being used here, the three-month Treasury bill rate. In the UK, we'd use a gilt yield, for example, as a measurement, or the Bank of England base rate. So you would get better returns than that. So those figures would be reduced. You would have a better chance of having beaten inflation with your cash. However, there is also something very important to bear in mind here, and that's that a lot of people don't do that. A lot of people have lots of money that they leave sat in legacy accounts, or they just leave sat in their current account. People accumulate savings account bonus periods end, fixed rates end, they don't move their money into better places. And I'd love to see some statistics on the amount of cash that's just sort of left sitting places versus the amount of cash that goes into the best deals. I've never seen anybody run those numbers. I'd love to see them. And that would give us a much better picture of what the actual return people are getting on their cash is. Cash gives you options, though. Cash gives you safety. And if you're not willing to take a risk, then, you know, it's great. But a chart like this does act as a major reassurance to anyone who is investing their money. And if you look at it over 10 years, you've got a 90% chance of beating inflation by investing. And in fact, you would genuinely hope to have a much better return than just inflation. But at least if it's just inflation, you're not losing money. And the only other thing to say is that, you know, a better time to invest is when stock markets are cheap than when they're very expensive. As to whether they're cheap at the moment, who knows? They've probably got further to fall, to be perfectly honest. But they're cheaper than they were. And if you think long term, you're probably going to do okay.
A bit of an abstract, perhaps, question. Crystal ball gazing, you're never going to know the answer to this, so it's just a, you know, idea. And you're always going to say, past performance is not blah, blah, blah. But is it possible that this is just such a totally unique moment in our economic history that the new normal will be nothing like what the past was?
Yeah, there's a strong possibility of that. I've got a story in front of me that says more than one in four staff laid off, official figures say. Mm-hmm. More than a quarter of the workforce has been temporarily laid off, according to official figures that underscore the depth of the problems facing the economy. So that's talking about the furlough scheme. I mean, there's an astonishing number of people who've been furloughed. There's an astonishing number of businesses that have just stopped work. We're starting to see some of them going back now. We've had the house builders say they're going to start building again this week. We've had some more of the shops and some of the restaurants open their doors to do delivery and stuff like that. Obviously, staff can't still go to the restaurant. And there does appear to be a little bit of quietly going back to work. Now, what's interesting about this is that the government, nobody's breaking any rules here. The government said, basically, people should work from home unless it was not possible for them to work from home. And a lot of these businesses, it's clearly not possible for a builder who works for a major house builder to work from home. They can't just, you know, go back to their house and knock up a block of flats in the garden. They're just doing, you know, what they're meant to be doing, and the builders are putting in social distancing to do it. I mean, how successful that's going to be, I don't know. But it does show that there is a little bit of a spring back in economic activity, and it does show that maybe some of these people who've been furloughed will only be furloughed for a very short period of time, and that they will go back to work. And it's true that the government has actually been surprised at the number of businesses that just shut down, stopped, or sent all their staff home, and the number of people who've been furloughed. They expected the furlough scheme to be popular and useful, and the idea was it was to stop mass redundancies. They never expected companies to furlough this many workers and so many companies to just stop. They thought a lot of companies would take the, well, we can't do working from home option. Now, what I would say here is that the ins and outs of the furlough scheme and the rights and wrongs of it, you know, are not really the thing being debated here. But I think companies deserve quite a lot of credit here, because an awful lot of businesses just went, this is very, very serious. Not doing business is going to basically seriously impact our business and put us at a serious risk. But we are going to place the well-being of our employees and our customers and the nation as a whole above that. And we're not just not going to work. And we've had a month of that now. Now, it's hardly surprising that after a month of that, people are starting to go back. But who knows what happens next? So, yes, I think you're absolutely right in saying that. There is one other thing to bear in mind with these figures, though, about the length, the period of time when you might lose money. OK, the measure of investing here is the S&P 500. It's the US stock market. Now, that means that you would only be invested in the US stock market. Now, you would have seen some very good gains from being only invested in the US stock market. But also, you're exposing yourselves quite heavily to a serious degree of risk by only investing in the stock market. A portfolio should have shares and bonds. And maybe some cash. And if you took for example, the best approximation of that, for example, a fund that was invested 60% shares, 40% bonds, then you would find that your likelihood of losing money over 5 years would be reduced.
Lee, I want to continue with investing, but I want to talk a little bit about stocks and shares, ISAs, because I did promise, and you've got a story on your website. All of this ties nicely together, that if you are feeling a little bit nervous right now, savings rates have been absolutely decimated. Experts, by and large, are still insisting the stock market is your best bet at growing your wealth long term. So if you are unsure...
Can I just interject there? Many of those experts do work for investment firms. It should be remembered. Never forget that many of the experts telling you that the stock market is the best place for your money do work for investment firms, and they might have a vested interest.
Simon makes an excellent point, as always there, Simon. Well done. For all those people who were Googling, or whatever you would use the search engine, for stocks and shares, ISAs, there are many leading fund supermarkets that offer ready-made ISA portfolios, which you could look into. And Lee, this is money you've been looking at what's on offer. So I want to say, do you agree with the experts? But, you know, you having no vested interest here, what are the benefits? Let's say, what are the pros and cons of ready-made ISA portfolios?
Firstly, what I'd say is we have seen since the start of March, where we've had two Bank of England base rate cuts, we've had a story on the website this week about savings rates. And we've seen savings rates, the number of accounts cut at the highest ever monthly level. We've seen the number of good deals disappearing at pace. So people will be looking at that and going, wow, okay, 1% is starting to become the new normal easy access Best Buy. And I think that is spooking people into action almost, going, cool, okay, well, where can I get some sort of returns or income now? And obviously we've seen all the stock market turmoil. Now, the story here is looking at some of the fund supermarkets, the DIY investment platforms that are available to people, and of course it's made up of some of the big names. People would have heard of places like AJ Bell, Hargreaves Lansdown, Vanguard, Fidelity. One of the most important things to consider when you're thinking about opening stocks and shares ISAs is the fees involved, because they can eat away at your returns, especially over the long term. So you should crunch the figures on that and make sure you're not overpaying. There's lots of competition out there and they all offer roughly the same thing. Another key thing to point out, and this goes back to me earlier saying, you know, investing has become a bit simpler. A lot of these places offer portfolios to match risk appetites, which makes it in people's head, I think, a little bit easier to digest. So, for example, AJ Bell has ones for cautious, balanced, adventurous, or one for investors wanting income. I think that makes it fairly clear as to, you know, what you can expect from it. You know, if you're going adventurous, you kind of know that the risk is going to be far higher. Yes, you may get bigger returns, but you might nurse heavier falls in market turmoil like we've seen. So it's important to pick the right one. They're kind of all worded a little bit differently on different different platforms. So Vanguard, for example, has its popular Life Strategy Fund range, which basically it puts it into passive funds, and it has a risk appetite by the amount of percentage of shares that are in riskier things that are going to probably return more cash, but again expose you to more turmoil. So it's worth just looking at all of these. I would investigate. We've got a whole part of the website, which I think you can access at thisismoney.co.uk/DIY investor. And it should show you all of the different options available. But, you know, they're so simple. And a lot of them just accept drip feed and cash. And that's why they've become so popular.
Fantastically. Well, we'll put that to one side and we'll take a look at one of the big stories of the week. Wow. Unprecedented, absolutely right. That's a word that's used fairly often, but I think in this case we can justify it. The price of oil this week, we saw it go negative briefly, basically meaning producers have to pay people to take it off their hands. So we have too much of it, with airlines grounded, people stuck at home. So the answer being, Simon, just turn off the taps, right? What's going on here?
Negative, yes. Now, what you have to bear in mind here is that when we say the price of oil went negative, that is the value of a barrel of West Texas Intermediate oil, also known as Texas Light Sweet. Although, don't eat it or drink it, folks. It's not sherry. Hit -$40.32. -$40.32. Now, in theory, that would mean that if you take a barrel of oil off someone's hands, you can pick up $40.30, which could lead to a whole new sharing economy idea. I heard someone joke on Twitter the other day, which I thought responded to and said it could be called WeTank, as people seek to store oil for people. But what this is to do with is the fact that, firstly, the WTI measure of oil is only one measure of the oil price. It's a US measure of the oil price, and it's a futures index price. So it's not really actually the price of a barrel of oil right now. You could not walk up to an oil producer in America and say, I tell you what, mate, I brought my own barrel, you fill it up,
give us some money,
and I'll take $40 off you. And the price of Brent crude dived as well, which is a more widespread measure around the world, but that didn't go negative. That hit about kind of $20, round about that mark, slightly below $20. But this is to do with the fact that in the US you have quite a lot of oil production at the moment, in fact a huge amount of oil production thanks to the whole shale boom, and the cost of producing that oil is pretty low to a lot of these producers. The marginal cost of producing the oil is pretty low. So as long as they can get more than about $7 or $8 a barrel, it's not worth them shutting down their production. The problem is, of course, is that nobody's using this oil at the moment. Well, I say nobody's using this oil. There's not anywhere near as much demand for this oil in future. So based on a futures contract, when that futures contract comes up, the traders have to pick up the oil and they have to store it. Now, the problem that we've got is that the storage facilities are full. There's a storage facility called Cushing in Oklahoma, a crucial storage hub for Texas Light Sweet. It's just got loads and loads of massive tanks where they store oil. And the massive tanks where they store oil is filling up. It's getting to the point now where there's no more storage left. So the producers are knocking out this oil and then it's being sold into the market. But the people who would be buying it in the market are struggling to find anywhere to store it. It's not being used quickly enough. So we're effectively, there's a massive oversupply. And that means that the futures market for that oil absolutely nosedived. And we had this really weird scenario where oil went negative. And it's fascinating, really. It's bounced back substantially since then. Yeah. And it's now around the $16 mark, and Brent crude is around $21 mark. But it's just another sort of marker of the very, very strange times that we live in. I'm trying to find a word to use that isn't unprecedented, because I believe that unprecedented has had an unprecedented amount of use recently and probably needs some form of unprecedented stop in its usage for the time being. But it really is quite difficult to think of other words, but well, we've never seen this one before, have we? And it goes back to your question of, is the world just going to go back to normal that you asked about in the investing thing before? And this feeds into what we're going to talk about in a minute about house prices, which is, I mean, I suppose it could just go back to normal and we could just pick up from where we went off. But in a week where the oil price went negative by a long way and we discovered that more than two people were now on the UK government's payroll, it would seem strange that we would just go back to normal.
I filled up the car yesterday and it cost me £1.08 per litre at the local BP garage. So there's a lot of experts out there saying that it should be dropping under a pound at forecourt. There are some where it has dropped under a pound, but of course people were driving.
Lee, did you not walk into the garage and say, I've just filled up my car, you owe me 30 quid?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I could have done, couldn't I? But it does highlight actually the collapse in Brent crude, how much of a litre of fuel is taxed. You know, 57.95 pence per litre fuel duty, 20 pence VAT. You know, it's not much more room for it to fall for drivers. Not that I think many drivers care at the moment, because there's not many long haul journeys going on. But that's the point, isn't it? Around the world, it's such a strange time in the fact that a lot of people aren't driving. And, you know, big consumer of oil, of course, planes have been grounded. No fuel's been sold there. So it's just crazy times, Georgie. And, you know, I just don't see where it all ends or where it all what
happens
next.
Amazon delivery drivers, though, doing their bit for the oil industry. No, I took my car out for the first time in 6 weeks or something, just to test that it still worked. And I was driving fast and saw 107.9, which was pretty good, which shows obviously what's been happening with the price of oil. But then I also saw plenty of 120, and I thought, well, that also goes to show how much you're ripped off elsewhere depending on where you go,
which is outrageous, because basically people are hardly using their cars at the moment, so people are not benefiting very much from this. But the people who are using their cars are the key workers, are the NHS, are the police, are the people like that who are still going to work and helping to look after everyone, and they're the ones being ripped off on the petrol. And the price of petrol, as Lee said, should be cheaper than it is now.
Well, talking about prices of things that we can't predict, from the price of oil to my favourite subject, the price of property. This week, Rightmove basically came out with what I've been saying all along, the slogan of old bung, didn't they, Simon? Okay, they didn't quite do that, but they did say that its latest statistics on values, property coming to the market and sales agreed were not meaningful. So what will happen to house prices? Can we even tell? Don't worry, because we'll get loads of people trying, won't we, Simon? What was Rightmove saying? Vindication at last for me?
Yes, it was an ironic twist for those house price watchers who regularly deride its index as meaningless because it's based on asking prices and you can ask whatever you want, but you might not get it. When Rightmove came out this week and said that its latest statistics on values, property coming to market and sales agreed were not meaningful. What it was saying was basically this period of time that the index covers goes back to just before the lockdown, and the pause button has been pressed on the housing market, as with everything else, but it's really been pressed really hard on the housing market, and valuations can't happen, viewings can't happen, most surveys can't happen, and the government has actually told people not to move home. What do you do? So understandably, in that scenario, not many people have decided to put their property on the market. I mean, a few have, and kudos to them, really, for the bravery, I would say. But not many people have decided to put their property on the market. So you can't really get any meaningful figures on asking prices. Although the asking prices of the properties that have come to the market, which is a teeny tiny amount, have actually been reasonably steady and didn't come down over the past month. I mean, good luck to those people is all I can say. Now, the question is, of course, that in a scenario where we've seen a wave of job losses, wages cut, we've got 70% of private firms having furloughed staff, got more than 2 million people furloughed on 80% of their wages that is being picked up by the taxpayer. We've got 1.2 million households who've asked for a mortgage holiday. Banks are building societies, getting the jitters and deciding to pull big chunks of their mortgages from the market. What's going to happen next? Now, there's been some interesting thoughts on this that have come out. I mean, the most succinct answer, as I wrote in my column, would be to simply say, who knows? But there have been some more detailed attempts, and these can chiefly be divided into two camps. We have the somewhat optimistic, things will pick up where they left off forecasts, which, speaking of vested interests, as we did earlier, appear to largely come from some of the cheerier estate agents. On the other hand, we have the suggestion that prices will fall, and then those predicted falls are by varying degrees of severity, but wonderfully sort of precise in their number that they'll put on them. So this week, analysts at Liberum said that looking at the stock market and the valuation of house builders, it's pricing in a 9.5% house price fall, which it thinks is actually a little bit too much. Its central case is a 7% fall once adjusted for inflation, and it described that as a soft landing. Now, you rarely get a 7% fall in the housing market described as a soft landing, but it modelled a number of different scenarios, including one with a greater than 16% decline, and then said what it thought would happen to house builders' shares off the back of it. The other week, we had economists at CEBR who predicted a 13% house price fall. EY's Howard Archer has a 5% fall penciled in. Estate agent and property consultancy Knight Frank has got 5% as well. Savills has a 5 to 10% fall. And a friend of This Is Money, Henry Pryor, who's a buying agent, he's talked previously about maybe a 5 to 10% in the short term, but he doesn't like to put numbers on stuff. But what he does say is that people will be reluctant to sell for a lower price, but there will be more people who don't have a choice but to take what they can get because of the three Ds, death, debt, and divorce, which will increase off the back of the coronavirus crisis. And then we have the prize for the most bullish prediction, which goes to a lady who works for an estate agent, Lucy Pendleton of estate agents James Pendleton, who said there are tremendous numbers of people who can't wait to go house hunting. She predicted the sale of the century and that prices would remain unchanged, adding, this all makes an early stampede followed by a very busy summer during the normally quiet months of July and August much more likely. I don't know about that.
God loves an optimist, but that to me does sound
a bit optimistic, doesn't it? A little bit optimistic. But I mean, look, on the positive side, there are some things that you need to remember. It's like, in order to have a crash, you generally need one of two things to be going on. You need mass forced sales of property, which is what happened in the early 1990s house price crash, which was a big one that lasted for a long time. Lots and lots of repossessions as people could no longer afford their mortgages. Or you need banks to stop lending. That was what happened in the financial crisis one. Banks suddenly went, oh, what have we done? No, you can't have a mortgage, to most people. And that sunk the housing market. Now, we don't necessarily have that this time round, because on the first point, it would be really weird if after the whole economy went on life support, banks gave everybody mortgage holiday. Banks gave loads of people mortgage holidays and were very, very heavily weighed upon to show something called forbearance, which in common language means not kicking people out of their houses. Mm. It would be very strange if they suddenly after that just suddenly cracked down on people and just repossessed a load of folk. I just can't see that one happening. Secondly, that's helped by the trend for fixed rate mortgages, which makes it very different time to the early 1990s when a lot more people were on variable rate mortgages. And also the increasing trend we've talked about on the podcast to opt for 5-year fixes instead of 2-year fixes, which helps cushion the blow and means that people won't suddenly find their payments jump. Also, you've got to remember interest rates are very low, and that mortgage affordability checks and mortgage rules have been much, much tighter in recent years. So it's been very difficult for people to go all out on the borrowing, the credit binge that we saw before the financial crisis with huge interest-only mortgages and stuff. Then you've also got to consider that banks went into this crisis with much better balance sheets than they went into the financial crisis one with, where they suddenly did, as I said, sat up and went, ooh, what have we done? And actually, until the coronavirus crisis hit, they were very, very eager to lend. In fact, they were more eager to lend money to people than people were to borrow money. And that meant there was a fierce mortgage price war going on. And mortgage rates were very, very cheap, which is why we haven't really seen them come down much since the cuts to the Bank of England base rate. Although there's been no shortage of banks swiftly writing to their customers still, and their savings rates are going to fall. But then you've got to think about the fact that they're going to be more cautious after this, aren't they? Banks aren't stupid. They're going to look at all the things I talked about earlier, about all that bad stuff that's gone on. They're going to have a wave of bad debts, probably not from individuals, but from companies going bust. And so they are not going to be as willing to lend such large sums to people. They're going to be much less likely to take things like bonuses, share options and stuff into account. They'll crank back on the amount they'll lend to people, especially at the sort of people with smaller deposits. And it's that, combined with very cheap mortgage rates, that's been keeping the whole caboodle afloat. So I think that the positive elements there will probably ease some of the falls. But I think that it's more likely than not that house prices will come down after this. Because ultimately, you know, house prices are a function of people's ability to pay for that house. For most people, the vast majority of the market, that ability is based on two things: wages and how much they can borrow. And both wages and how much they can borrow have been seriously crimped by the coronavirus crisis.
But Simon, come summer, we're all going to be out there and going mad. It's going to be back to normal.
That's the shortage of property for sale argument versus the number of people who want to move. There is undoubtedly going to be lots of people who want to move. And there's talk about interesting things that might happen, like people will be more willing to live further out of town because there's going to be more working from home and they want to be closer to the countryside and have a garden. But, you know, overall, the thing that shifts the market is money, and money's going to be tighter.
All right, Lee. Well, assuming that people will still want to buy and people still want to sell, and perhaps you want to sell your house fairly quickly after lockdown measures are lifted, whenever that might be, and budgets are tight, you've actually been looking at some pretty simple steps that you can take to boost your chance of a speedy sale, including some basic home improvements, a bit of tidying up. What's in there, Lee?
Yeah, so we've got six tips here. They're all fairly straightforward, to be quite frank with you. And we've seen a rise in people kind of wanting to do these sort of DIY tasks, perhaps things that they've put off for quite a long while because they've got more time. But of course, with that, there's been a lot of DIY shops that haven't been open, so it's not been as easy to get the materials that are needed. But we have seen this week, actually, Simon said earlier in the show about some places that are opening up. We've seen more than half of B&Q stores have reopened this week. That they were doing a click and collect online thing anyway, but you can actually go in now. So they've reopened. So these are tips from NAEA Property Mark, which represents estate agents. Number one is a lick of paint. Now that's indoors, exterior and interiors. You know, places can look quite tired, and it's always good, in my opinion, if you look to sell a home, to keep it relatively neutral. So that's the first tip. And the second one is decluttering. A lot of people are guilty of this, you know, cramming things around the home. People want to see a space that's clear so they can envision living in it and where they're going to put furniture and so forth. We've actually hired a skip here this week. I'm doing a big clear out of our own home, not looking to sell it, but, you know, it's good just to have a good clear out here and there. And seeing as the local pump isn't open and all that kind of stuff, I think quite a few people are probably doing that. And the person on the phone said that they've had a lot of demand from households looking to get skips. So cluttering, preening the garden. We've seen a lot of people taking an interest getting green fingers in recent weeks. If you're lucky enough to have a garden, always need more TLC, I think, than what you realise, with the de-weeding, cutting the lawn and fence panels seem to be needed to be replaced all the time. People like a nice, clean, tidy garden. You can do things like, perhaps if you haven't got a barbecue out there, just get a cheap one just so people can kind of see that outdoor living and the potential to do that. Washing windows, giving them a good clean. It sounds simple. It sounds a bit off. The amount of times people have grimy looking windows is astonishing. The kitchen, they point out, is one of the sort of best weighs, you know, it's one of the first things that buyers look for, and it's such an important room. And they recommend basically just giving all the cupboards and surfaces a deep clean, and consider painting any old or worn cupboards, which are, you know, relatively simple way to do it. And the last one actually is what I kind of touched on earlier, is to avoid over personalization. So, you know, if you've got a bit of sort of wacky taste, it's okay. You know, that's your own thing, but you got to try and tone it down a bit. You know, the leopard print rugs and the strange duvet sets, all that kind of stuff, just try and keep it as neutral as possible so people can look at it and know they can stamp their own character on it without having to do loads of work.
Good tips there. I particularly like the decluttering. Can I just say and re-emphasise the appeal from charity shops? For God's sakes, they're not open at the moment. So please don't leave your junk or the stuff that could be resold and given to charity outside them at the moment. No one is collecting. No. Anyway, that's just an appeal from charity shops there and from me. Finally, Simon. We've been hearing a lot about insurers not paying out for cancelled holidays, for weddings. That's the latest one. Now it's a turn of businesses, I'm afraid. One company particularly coming under the spotlight, being threatened with legal action. Over 200 British businesses have joined together to start the Hiscock Action Group. So they plan to sue the Veteran Lloyds of London insurer for not paying out, despite the fact that these firms bought cover for forced closure due to disease. Simon, explain. How are they getting away with that?
Okay, this is a really, really interesting story. When the, or just before the lockdown, actually, wasn't it? When the government basically asked all the sort of pubs and restaurants and places to close, but didn't order them to do it, there was this story that did the rounds that because they'd done that, people's insurance wouldn't pay out. And it was then pointed out, actually, by the insurance industry that most people did not have policies that would cover them anyway. That they didn't have that in there. They didn't have cover for like a government ordering closure because of disease kind of thing in their policies. So it wouldn't have made any difference anyway. And then the government came out and said, look, just to clarify this, this is, you know, we're considering this notifiable. And that means that if you do have it in your policy, it should pay out. But most people don't have it in their policy. Now, some people did have policies that said that in the event of infectious disease, and they would get paid out on business interruption grounds. And so a number of those people were with an insurer called Hiscox. Hiscox has a reputation for being at the pricier end of the premiums, but you get good quality insurance. They insure things that other insurers may not cover, and they are more likely to pay out. Now, Hiscox has said that it's not paying out for this. Now, what makes this very interesting is that we've spoken to some of the policyholders who are fighting this in the action group, and the policy documents that we have seen state that cover includes firms, and I quote here, inability to use the insured premises due to restrictions imposed by a public authority during the period of insurance following an occurrence of any human infectious or human contagious disease, an outbreak of which must be notified to the local authority. Now, if I had an insurance policy that said that and my business couldn't operate at the moment, I'd probably think that I had a pretty good grounds to claim on my insurance policy. And I'd think, well done me for taking out that policy and having the foresight to do so. Understandably, that's what quite a few of the people who have these policies think. Now, one business owner, Duncan Murray, who spoke to us, he runs the Lou Trenchard Manor Hotel in Devon, which has obviously had to shut. He was informed his claim was being rejected because coronavirus was not reported at his hotel specifically. So the insurer said, but that means that you've got to have coronavirus at your hotel, and then you had to close your hotel because of it. It's not a catch-all. We've got other companies who have been told that they won't be paid out for similar reasons. We spoke to one company, H. Newton Hale and Sons in Birkenhead, family-owned wholesaler to the retail trade. It employs 65 people. It's been running for 91 years. Stephen Hale, who runs the firm, told Will Kirkman, our reporter, who's done a great investigation into this, we bought business interruption as part of everything else that we needed to. It was sold to us on the basis that we would be covered if our business was interrupted. But our broker is now refusing to make a claim for us. They say there's no point as we aren't covered for coronavirus. We paid our premium every month, And then when we really need it, they're not there for us. It's disgraceful, it's and it's unbelievable, and it's immoral. Now, Hiscox is saying that its insurance was not meant to cover something like coronavirus. There is actually a thing in the insurance world where it doesn't only matter what the exact wording of the policy is, it's also what the underwriters intended the policy to cover. This is why this is likely to go to court and end up in a big argument. And it's very interesting to see what happens. And a spokesman for the ABI told us, insurers know that this is a very worrying time for businesses. While most business insurance does not cover for pandemics, overall UK insurers expect to pay over 1 billion in COVID-19 related claims. Unfortunately, no country in the world has an insurance market that is able to offer widespread pandemic cover. Forcing insurance companies to pay for risks that aren't covered in contracts would be a shortcut to their insolvency. Given the sheer scale of economic impact, extensive pandemic insurance cover can only happen with some form of government support. And we need a debate about how best this can be achieved in the future. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens here. And just to give Hiscox's side of this, a spokeswoman for Hiscox said, "We understand these are incredibly difficult times for businesses, and we are paying claims that are covered by the policies we issue fairly and quickly. We review each case individually, and if any customer has concerns about the application of their policy, we encourage them to get in touch with us directly." Now, the comment from people in the know about some of this insurance stuff is maybe Hiscox might be right here, and maybe Hiscox will win this, but that could be damaging to Hiscox anyway, because its reputation as this insurer, you know, quality payouts, everything like that, covers the stuff other people don't do, is undoubtedly going to be dented by all of the stories about this and the people reading it. And the next time their broker says, "Well, I think you should go with Hiscox because Hiscox," they'll go, "Nah, because they ain't going to pay anyway." Whereas before they would have gone, "Okay, all right, I believe you, they'll pay." The other side of it is that maybe Hiscox will have to pay out because basically it's just written its policy terms a little bit too loosely, and it needed to be more specific in them. But it's a very, very interesting case, and includes a lot of people who were really genuinely worried about their businesses going to the wall and thought, quite rightly in many cases, that actually they were covered.
I'm sure we'll have more cases like this, not just businesses, but like I said, travel, weddings, all sorts. Do keep us up to date on that. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything that you would like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. And at this point, before we stop, we traditionally stop, I hope people are still listening, I have two things that I want to say. Firstly, from a listener who did actually email us with the subject line, police.
Right.
No, it is not Sting deciding to chip in his two penny worth on the financial issues of the day. This is a reader who said to us, "Good morning. I have been a keen listener of your podcast for years and generally enjoy the content. Can you please stop bashing the police? I think this may be related to us taking the mickey out of the police for some of their drone-related activities. Yeah. Police officers are still attending work every day, putting themselves at risk, getting spat and coughed at and generally assaulted and having to disregard social distancing to arrest violent offenders whilst others stay at home. Police are doing their best to implement rules rushed through Parliament that the NHS desperately want enforced as they are at breaking point. You will always get the odd officer who gets a bit carried away, and these are the ones that naturally hit the headlines. The majority of officers use common sense, are reasonable, and are actually petrified that they might take the virus home to their families, some of which are at risk. I really thought you had a finger on the pulse with matters generally and normally give a balanced view. The public would notice if there was no police about with disastrous consequences. Other key workers are quite rightly receiving praise, and it's about time police were considered amongst this group and praised. Not many would deal with the danger they do on a daily basis." So, in response to that, I would say, yes, I take my hat off, my metaphorical hat off, to the police. I think that they do a very good job. I have a huge amount of support for the police that you see out there on a daily basis, dealing with stuff in a common sense manner, you know, and realizing that you police by consent in this country, and that the best way to police is to take the public with you, because then you're the public are your eyes and ears. There's been lots of effort to try and do more of that in recent years that has been undermined, unfortunately, by cuts to the policing budget. The problem is not the ordinary police officers in most cases, although, as this reader points out, there will always be the odd one that is officious and gets carried away and likes to wield the power in a way that is not done in a fair way, or will not brook any argument when someone says to them, but I'm not doing anything wrong. They just get, right, I've got the power, you don't. But most of them are not like that, okay? The problem, I think, is with some of the people up top in some of the police forces and the way that they have decided to sort of picture themselves and promote themselves in this. And I think it's probably would be a good idea if the police forces didn't have the Twitter accounts that they post their drone footage on in the first place. But yeah, hats off to the police, and thank you to this reader for getting in touch. And yes, if you are in the police, if you have a member of family who's in the police or anything else, and you feel that we were unfair when we were talking about it and making a bit of a joke about some of the police action, then I do apologise for that. And also, on a lighter note, I will give you an update on my holiday refund situation. For those listeners listening in to the Lambert EasyJet saga, including the morning when EasyJet grounded its entire fleet and then an hour later sent me an email inviting me to check in online and reminding me to do so that my family could sit together. After repeatedly trying to phone EasyJet and just getting a message that said, we're very, very busy at the moment, and then just went, please call back later, and hung up on me, I gave up and went online and decided to fill in the contact form and send them an email. And I said, just sent them a very nice email. And amazingly, I got an email back from EasyJet a few days later from someone who said, very sorry that we've had to cancel your flights, you know, in the circumstances and everything, and you've struggled to get through. I explained to them that I didn't want a voucher. And I didn't want to change my flights because I didn't have anywhere that I was planning to go in order to use it. Reasonable. So could I just have my money back? And they said, yes, you can have your money back. They've refunded me the money. The money has already gone onto my credit card.
Wow.
So there you go. They have since put a cash refund button back on their site, which I haven't checked whether it's still there today. Hopefully it is. But if you are having problems, then maybe just try emailing them instead of phoning and try and be nice in the email. I don't know. Or maybe I just got a nice person. Who knows? But I also managed to get through to BA as well. And I've managed to get BA to refund
when
the flights.
When you say Ryanair, then I wouldn't just not believe a word you're saying.
BA cancelled mine and my friend's flights in June to Beirut on the 11th of March before we even went into lockdown or anything like that. But I didn't phone them at the time, stupidly, to get the money back, which I should have done. I thought, oh, they'll probably be too busy. I can't bother to phone them. I'll phone them now. They obviously got a lot busier since. But I did, after spending ages sitting on hold on the phone, get through, and someone at BA has refunded the money for those flights as well. So keep fighting for those flight and holiday refunds, people. You might get there in the end.
You might do. Thank you very much, Simon, for your own stories there. Also, Lee takes his literal hat off and I take my metaphorical hat off as well to the police too. And for all the key workers out there at the moment, thank you very much for getting in contact with us. See, we do read them. If you like our podcast, please do rate us on iTunes. It helps people find us.